So you have BVFS on top, and then you have a whole bunch of data servers. There are of course some metadata servers as well, which store information about how that virtualized BVFS file system is all put together, which provides things like naming and so on. You might want to read up a little bit about TUL, about BVFS. The idea is that BVFS creates large files by splitting these large files across multiple data servers. So, and each of those fragments of files are stored as an independent file within the underlying file system, to the underlying file system, which could be EXT3 or some form of native file system that manages actual storage. BVFS does not really manage storage on its own. It just manages the file namespace. But it provides the unified view for clients, which are basically the compute nodes or the visualization nodes. Any node that has access to all the data has to go through the BVFS to access any file. So it has to look up, for instance, put a name query saying I want this file, and then the metadata server will respond saying that this file at this offset is located in this data server, and then the clients can communicate directly with the data server. So there is a BVFS server and a BVFS client. So the compute nodes or and visualization nodes which want to access the BVFS file system will have a stub, you know, BVFS client stub, which will take care of doing the handshaking with the metadata server and then do the transfer of data with the data server.
Another layer box, which is BVFS client.
These are actually clusters themselves. These are high performance clusters. So you have, let's say, SVC cluster 1, which is doing some, atmospheric simulation models, right? So using this, you can do predictions of weather, right, things like that. You can have HPC cluster 2, which does some, discovery of genes or whatever, so on, so genetic stuff, right? And then you can have another HPC cluster, which does visualization of data, right? So most of these guys which doing simulation are all mostly creating write traffic. And so write traffic not just in terms of the simulation output, what they create, but also checkpointing traffic. Because periodically they need to write their entire state, because these simulation models run for days and sometimes even months, And if there is a power loss, you lose all the data that you, all the computations that you made. So you have to continuously save state. So you can think about, say, state saving at every half an hour granularity. So every half an hour there is a whole bunch of data that's coming through for a checkpoint into the data server. So these visualization guys are going to read the data that is, the output of these other simulation clusters to do some sort of visualization so that scientists can do whatever it is that they need to do. Now, you have not one, but a whole bunch of data servers. All the PDFs files are striped across these data servers. So that's something to keep in mind. Why is that? Because so if you have a really large file, most of these files are large, gigabytes and even hundreds of gigabytes. What BVFS will do is create multiple chunks of these files and store and send to each data server a chunk which gets stored as an independent file within the local file system. So internally, you have one or more local file systems here. I'll draw the same picture that I had before. These are 10 disks, and then you have 48 such drives, 48 such RAIDs. And so if this guy...
So there are 8 data centers.
8 plus 1, 8 plus 2, RAID 6.
In presentation, I'll just say RAID because we didn't need external data.
I think it's fine to say RAID 6, that's fine. Don't be shy to say things because you've not done something, right? So you have like this whole bunch of 480 disk drives that is being managed by a single data server.
So what are the sizes usually?
Of each disk?
No, for the entire data server, typically. Like terabytes?
Let's say that our disk drives are 250 gigabytes.
Okay.
I think the disk drives are going to be bought based on the price points, right?
Okay.
And for instance, the DOE guys, I don't know what they buy. They probably buy SCSI drives because they're more reliable.
Mm-hmm.
And those are more expensive, but also lower capacity. I think you can buy SCSI drives of 160 gigabytes. So even if it's 160 gigabytes, let's just say it's 100 gigabytes each drive, then it's 480 times 100 gigabytes, which is 48 terabytes per data server.
Okay.
Right?
And
you have many data servers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, the key is that you have LVMs that are being carved out of these. So you have the LVMs are spread across the RAID, and all of them store independent file systems.
Right.
Right? So this could be an AXCP, this could be a riser, whatever it is that you need for your workload, whichever performs the best. Now, the question is, where does Borg fit in? So, in such, this is a large-scale system, right? So, you have to agree with that. And then, natural question is, in this whole picture, where does Borg fit in? I mean, does Borg fit in here? Or does Borg fit in into a PDFS? Does it fit in into the one part which I didn't draw was the metadata servers, right? So, there is not one, but multiple metadata servers, right? Does it fit in there? Does it fit in inside the data server? Does it fit in for each disk?
Right.
That's the sort of questions that we have to answer.
Right.
Remember that this is a RAID 6, a hardware RAID 6, so there is a RAID controller here
for
a RAID 6. Does Borg fit in the RAID controller?
Right. No.
Okay, so where does it fit in this big picture?
Yeah.
It can fit in any of many different locations, right? But where is the best place to put it?
Yes, it is.
We don't know. I mean, so here's one suggestion.
Right.
Don't say that this is the best place. Say that this is our suggestion, that you can put Borg here. Because you can only say it's the best place when you have actually tried all the alternatives, have all the results, have all the data to back up that claim that it is the best place. We think that this is a good place to put it, right? That have Borg running inside the data servers. So there's an independent Borg instance running within each data server. Actually, this is a metadata server, but depending on whether the metadata server has any persistent storage, you could put one inside the metadata server as well. But putting it here would then, the next question is, well, how do you configure Borg?
Mm-hmm.
How do you set up the BOPT partition and so on? So the answer, you know, this is what could be a reasonable answer, and you certainly need to think more about this, right? It's just a suggestion.
Right.
So you could carve out an LVM,
just
like all these other LVMs are carved out of these multiple RAIDs for a BOPT partition.
Right.
And then what are why would you want to do something like this? You could optimize all the LVMs as an independent problem. So even if I put BOPT on one of these RAIDs, I could still monitor the traffic to all the LVMs and copy data in there.
No, but if it's tried to cross, you would have, I mean, the reason why the data is tried to cross the different RAIDs is because of the load balance. You don't want one single RAID to be the bottleneck, right?
Correct. So rather than saying because we can optimize all the LVMs, you have to say that so we can load balance the BOPT accesses across all the disk drives across all the 480 disk drives.
Right. No, the other option I was thinking of was to put Borg, like suppose you don't want to optimize all the LVMs because you just want to optimize this
one.
Then you could
use Borg
in here.
What do you mean in here?
BOPT. You could partition this LVM to have a BOPT, right? If it's trying to solve the different
ways again. No, LVMs are independent partitions. They cannot be further partitioned. This is one assumption.
Well,
that
you don't have to actually physically partition the LVM. You just say that from this, like the LVM would have some static on the end, right? Any range, right? So if you just say that this from here to here is a BOPT and the rest of it is a normal LVM.
But isn't that what we are doing here?
Right, yeah, but well, my point is you have multiple LGMs, and if you do something with this, of course they will optimize for LGMs.
Not necessarily.
Or you specify which one you're talking
about. You can do that. I mean, there is no restriction. There is no requirement that you have to optimize all the LVMs. You can configure Borg so that the access only to this LVM should be optimized inside the DOPD partition.
Right, yeah.
So you have ARM moving between LVM2 and DOPD, that's fine because I know that LVM2 is not accessed at all, so I don't care about that.
Right.
So you could do those things, but the point is that just by configuring a BOPT partition this way does not force you to optimize for any specific LVM or all the LVMs. But remember that monitoring is an independent process than the data movement. So you can monitor, create access graphs for any LVM that you need.
Or
all of them if you want. So the key reason why this makes sense is because then assuming that Borg is able to capture working sets across all the LVMs so that it's all co-located or most of the axes are co-located inside the BOPD partition, we want to be able to utilize all the bits for the accesses into the BOPD.
Right.
The only way to do that was to create an LVM that spans all the range.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Actually, this figure is non-intuitive. It's misrepresenting some information. It seems like I'm creating an LVM that only spans the first disk, but that's not true.
It could have more than one.
Yeah. So what you can do is you can think about how to make the figure so that that is clarified, so that you don't compartmentalize the boxes into. So one thing which you could do is you can start with a picture that has these internal disk drives just to show the hardware configuration.
Right.
Then you can remove these sub boxes. So you only have a remaining picture that looks like this. These are the RAIDs.
Okay.
There's no disk drives in this. And then you can do like this. I think that's fine.
Okay. But then again, it's not 2 hours, right? It could be just like.
It could be part, but that's in some sense that depends on the administrator and the requirements of the workload.
Yeah, but it could be. Right?
It's an atypical LVM.
But how do they have it all? Do they have like fixed allocations for each LVM or is it just allocation?
When you say fixed, does it change or not change? Is that fixed?
Yeah, like can they change or increase or reduce the size of each LVM?
I don't know. I didn't talk in that much detail.
Well, yes, it
depends on.
Usually, LVM can be any size.
I think it depends on what kind of. You're using a storage vendor which is first data or something like that. It's a very non popular storage vendor. It's not any of the big guys, not NetApp or Panasis or any of those. So, Argonne has. I think it's first data, if I'm not mistaken. I think it is first data, but I can check.
Okay.
I think you can also find out which storage they're using by going to the Argonne site. They have lots of information about their cluster and so on.
Oh.
I think the vendor information should also be there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do something like this, then it does not create that confusion.
Yeah,
I think we'll be back to the So you can say that, I mean, by configuring the LVM so that within each RAID you occupy a partition of the RAID, and then that is partitioned across, or that is, you do the same thing across all the RAIDs. Then you build an LVM out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You retain the access properties of the BOPD partition, which is that it's all co-located within a single disk, and you have the opportunity to reduce both seek and rotational delay within each individual disk.
Right.
Right. Now, so that's really the question. Maybe one thing which could be done is to suggest some rules of thumb for setting up the RAID chunk sizes So if you set up larger chunk sizes, then there is more sequentiality within each disk. I think that's something which it's a parameter that can potentially affect the Borg performance.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the real chunk size? Because the sequentiality, otherwise, you know, what you think is sequential is actually striped across two disks. And in some sense, the same issue that you have with the RAID experiments, right?
Right.
Is your BOPD is not all contiguous within a single disk anymore. It's actually partitioned across two disks.
Right. Depending on what you have. So in this case, even if you had, I mean, it could also not get much performance.
What?
Right. So that this LVM has these two disks, and this LVM comes from these two disks, right? And if you put the data, the popular data,
No, LVMs are not. This is a misleading figure. That's why it shouldn't be drawn this way. Each LVM.
Oh, just a logical space.
Yeah, it's striped.
Right.
So you have to think about this LVM. Okay, let's draw a more simpler configuration. Okay. With, I think that's the reason I told you to think about this figure.
Okay.
So each LVM is spanning all the disks within each RAID.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say I have only two RAIDs.
Okay.
With three disks each.
Okay.
So here's my first RAID. Second RAID, and I want to create an LVM similar to here. So it's just a miniature version of this problem. The first thing I'll do is partition.
Okay.
Now I have I can create two LVMs.
So I just make all this. This would be a part of one LVM.
Correct.
Okay. And then another. This could be a part of the other LVM.
Yeah.
Okay. So they have to span, they have to use all of this.
Not that they have to,
well,
but you can set it up this way.
Okay.
And this is how they have it in Argon.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. I'm just want you to be very careful about the terminology you use. For instance, have to, and just be careful about what you're saying. Because
okay.
I know that that's not what you have in mind, but in the end, what matters is what the other person hears.
Okay.
Right, and their interpretation is not based on some insight into how you're thinking or
right.
what you're thinking. It's just your words.
Right.
So keep listening to you over and over again and figure and see if there are words that you can be interpreted in a different way than what you intend them to be.
Okay.
And this is for your presentation, of course. But it's also important for technical communication.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're having a brainstorming session with someone at your future employer, then they might be confused. Even I'm confused sometimes by the things that you say because
yes.
you don't use the words correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I know what you mean because I would think that way. But if you're going into more complex discussion, I cannot figure out what you actually want to say, especially if your words don't reflect that. Right?
Okay. Yes.
Okay, so yeah, I think this much detail is more than sufficient for your presentation.
Okay.
And maybe you don't need all this detail. You can just paint a high level picture.
Okay. And I also put that to the discussion.
There might be some question about how you do it on a NetApp system, which I have no idea about. But if you want, we can discuss that. If you have some ideas about certain NetApp systems, we could talk about that. If you have experience working with a specific piece of hardware at NetApp that you know the details about, or even if you don't know, GD might expect you to know the details. You want to find out about it and figure out how to set up board on such a system.
Yes. I'm not really sure how the systems are set up because I don't work on these systems. But I need to kind of find some information online about the architecture. But in any case, the waffle makes it a little difficult, right? Because, I mean, because of the right anywhere layout, the BOPT would be filled up very soon.
Yeah.
because it is overnight the data.
What do you mean by filled very soon?
Well, I mean, if you have more write requests coming in, and because Waffle does the write and inner.
Why are there more requests in Waffle than EXP3? More write requests.
Because Waffle does not delete data. Like, it won't override the data. It'll keep the old data to be used in snapshots.
Okay, so. And how does that create more write requests?
It doesn't create more write requests, it just uses more space.
Okay.
Because it doesn't override lock.
Okay.
But in, for, like, we have a BOPT with a write buffer.
Hmm.
And if we have a new write, we write it into the OPT. If we have a safe write to the same buffer, we override it.
Hmm.
But that's not the case in case of buffer.
Hmm.
If we have a write, we're going to write to the BOPT.
Sure.
Another write to write to a new location in the BOPT.
Okay. So the first question is that are writes already optimized in Waffle? Is there a need to further optimize them?
Well, writes are optimized in the sense they're co-located. But sequentiality may not be there because of fragmentation.
Fragmentation, but you said you don't delete any.
You don't delete them, but once. Okay. So these are your. Okay. So this is the right buffer, right? And if this is to the SS block A, write to the SS block A. Another write to the SS block A would be written here.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be stored as a snapshot.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be deleted. Unless the snapshot is reclaimed when it becomes really old.
Okay. So that's why there is some free space.
Right.
And then how is that
so
free space used?
Well, so this becomes, and this quickly becomes more fragmented because, you know, you have these holes and snapshots are reclaimed.
Okay.
So because of the fragmentation, you cannot have sequentiality in the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have co-location because then you have, you know where the, you know, which allocation area your heads of all the disks in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then you can try to keep them, or try to minimize the head movement by picking the closest allocation area.
Mm-hmm.
So they're optimizing in terms of co-location, but they don't have increased sequentiality.
Okay, so the sequentiality can possibly increase more.
Yeah, but it has the same problem as the original system, right?
Gee,
there should be fragmentation involved, and in fact, ball will be out of space sooner because it's a small partition.
Mm-hmm.
If it absorbs the new write, it's going to be out of space.
But wouldn't that just mean that, okay, now I have to flush my data earlier from my BOPT to create more space, so I have to do reconfiguration at the correct time.
Yeah, but that is true. But you have to do more frequent reconfiguration.
That depends on the rate at which the writes are being done. I understand your point that it's always to new locations, but sometimes it's old locations, right? So when you're reclaiming stuff, you're writing to one.
But it doesn't override the same location. Okay? It can reclaim the block, but it doesn't override to the same location.
Then how does it reclaim if it's not reusing the space?
Well, it's not. Okay, so. What I mean is, like an ESP3 file system would override that block A.
Yeah, I understand that, but eventually there is an overwrite operation after you reclaim.
Yeah.
So at that point, you write to the same location as before, you write different data.
Yeah.
Which is what happens anyway. You write new data.
But I guess they have a write anywhere strategy because they want to optimize
that. So writes are more efficient in Waffle
than
a traditional file system. That's what you're saying.
Right, yeah.
So then the question is, do you want to use another level of optimization with the write buffer,
right,
which provides sequentiality, but then it incurs the overhead of flushing to the static locations later on. If writes are mostly sequential with waffle, then maybe it's not worth copying it in a different location and then moving it again.
Mm-hmm. The reads can possibly be optimized.
Yeah. And especially with waffle, the reads are highly fragmented.
Right.
So you can make the case for a read cache only board.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Which basically operates only solely based on reads.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Do you think you should put this also in the slide or in the back?
You have to have an answer to Evie's question. Don't bring up waffle because you're not an expert, and I don't think even you understand the depth of all the concerns with waffle.
Okay.
So don't bring up something that someone else in the committee is better at, unless they bring it up.
Okay.
If they bring it up, then you need to be prepared.
Okay.
This is your defense, so you are expected to talk about the things that you are supposed to be an expert on by now, right? Because you are talking about material that you have the best knowledge about, or you are supposed to have the best knowledge about. Even your committee members should not have as much knowledge about this material as you, right? Because you are supposed to spend all your time on that material. If you bring up something that you're not an expert on, it might raise a lot of questions that you don't want.
Okay.
Yeah, what I would recommend is to practice, make your presentation, improve it based on the comments today, and then just keep practicing. There is no such thing as over practicing.
Yeah.
Right? But don't practice to the extent that you do not sleep.
Okay,
that's over practicing. Then that's a problem.
Okay.
You need a good night's sleep, like I say always, before any major event you need to sleep really well.
Yeah.
There is no replacement for a good night's sleep. So but at the same time, make sure that you practice enough number of times.
Okay.
And listen to yourself if at all possible.
Okay. I'll send you an updated version of the presentation.
Yeah, and like I said, your attitude has to be completely different on that day. Right? You have to be more formal, you have to be more precise, and you have to stand up straight first of all, right? You cannot take the support of the table or the chair or anything of that sort.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll probably be near the screen.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I think that's